Teaching is our passion. We at The Wall Street Skinny are proud to announce that we've joined the advisory board for the iConnections Funds for Teachers initiative, focused on supporting the Ron Clark Academy and its pioneering teaching methods. Through Funds for Teachers, iConnections is dedicated to empowering educators nationwide by providing access to RCA's professional development opportunities. Events are being organized in major cities throughout the year to fundraise and support this incredibly important cause. All proceeds from these events will be directly donated to the Ron Clark Academy, specifically to financially aid teachers so they can participate in RCA's groundbreaking training programs. Please click on the link in our show notes to register for an event in the city nearest you. This is The Wall Street Skinny, a podcast devoted to exploring the financial services industry and making the world of Wall Street accessible to everyone. Hi, friends. Welcome back to The Wall Street Skinny. I'm Jen.
I'm Kristen.
And we are two lifelong friends with a combined 25 years of experience working and teaching on Wall Street, here to give you the skinny today on investment strategy from the standpoint of something called a superannuation fund, aka a pension fund. And listen, before you're like, oh God, pension funds, that sounds boring. Every single time we talk about institutional investors on this podcast, whether it be the LPs who participate in some of the private investment strategies like private equity, private credit, all kinds of different asset management, right? What we're really talking about is people who are managing money on behalf of institutional investors like pension funds. And when you have all those people out there saying, Wall Street is so evil, my pension fund was defunded after the global financial crisis of 2008. I don't understand why you're defrauding all of the firefighters and teachers out there. Well, guess what? We are here to explain today how these funds work to grow the money that all of these people need, especially in other countries besides the United States, where public policy has a much more socialist approach and people can build wealth that will continue to take care of them as they age vis-a-vis these pension funds. So it's going to be a really exciting conversation with John Normand, who was head of fixed income strategy. They called it cross-asset strategy, but think everything from interest rates, FX, credit, commodities, et cetera, at JP Morgan. He is now head of strategy at this Australian super. He's based in London. He is a philosopher. He also has more degrees to his name and titles and certifications than pretty much anyone else we've talked to. He's so impressive. This is going to be such an interesting conversation. This is a do not miss. Let's bring him on. We are joined here today by John Normand. And John, you have an incredible resume that spans a 30-year career in fixed income strategy that encompasses everything from foreign exchange to rates to emerging markets. And you were primarily on the sell side at JP Morgan, but now you're on the buy side and you're the head of strategy at an Australian super. So I would love it if you could please walk us through your bio and your career path to kick us off.
Sure. So first, thank you for inviting me onto your show. I've listened to the podcast before. You've had a good friend of mine on your podcast as well. So I'm looking forward to the next half hour or so with you all. So in terms of my background,
Ashish connected us, right?
He sure did. And he's someone that I had the good fortune to meet about 15 years ago with JP Morgan, and we remained friends ever since.
So that's awesome.
It's a great connection. So my career was largely spent at JP Morgan doing a range of strategy roles, currencies, interest rates, commodities, asset allocation. And when you look at my background, it seems like there must have been a number of deliberate and very well thought out steps along that way because of the nature of the career progression. But as I think you probably found out from interviewing a lot of people from your show, a lot of these career paths, including mine, end up being kind of circuitous and a little more accidental than that. So very little, I think, of my background would have inclined me to have spent almost 30 years on Wall Street. I grew up in a small town in Louisiana. I went to undergraduate on the East Coast. I studied economics, which might incline people to go to Wall Street, but because I'd never met a Wall Street in my life, I had never actually heard of any investment banks when I was at Georgetown undergrad. I was very much focused on getting a job in public policy in Washington, working for the State Department of Trade rep or something. Mm-hmm. I went from Georgetown to do a graduate degree in economics and public policy at Princeton. And it was during my second year there that the peso crisis hit. I became quite interested in this intersection, public policy and finance. And I thought, why don't I move to New York and work in finance for a couple of years, and then I'll go back to DC and get that job at State or Treasury or the US trade rep. And then I just never left Wall Street. I just found it fascinating to be in an environment where everything that I liked about economics and finance and international affairs and geopolitics, it all came together. And I had to synthesize that every day and make a decision as to whether that meant a market up or down. Mm-hmm. So for someone who had interest in a lot of different things, Wall Street ended up unwittingly being a great place to be. And because I was lucky enough to end up at a place like JP Morgan, which became an endgame winner in finance as the most profitable investment bank in the history of the world, it afforded me all these career opportunities that I never aimed for, angled for, that the place was just growing and it was constantly delivering all sorts of chances to cover different markets and to connect with different clients and to have more responsibility. So I stayed with it for a very long time, and I had sort of multiple careers within that institution covering different asset classes. And after about maybe 20 years, it gets routine. You know, even if you're doing it at a place that's growing, there is something almost mechanical about writing reports every Friday.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be interesting to get much closer to investment decision-making by moving to the buy side. I didn't want to do that directly from investment banking. I wanted to go back to school because I just had this itch to get a degree in philosophy, which probably comes from being educated with some Jesuits at Georgetown and feeling like until you really understand the reasons why you believe everything you do and the justifications you offer for your actions, you probably haven't thought about things enough. And so LSE, which is where I went for that master's, offered these one-year master degrees in things like philosophy and lots of other courses. I got in, I went, and then I moved to the buy side. So I was extremely fortunate to have been able to make those moves at the right time, but very, very little of that was deliberate.
So backing up a step, you have one of the most robust educational pedigrees of anyone we've ever spoken to. We were joking that we didn't even know that the CFA level four existed. You've got the philosophy degree. We get asked a ton about the value of these advanced degrees and certifications on Wall Street in general, and they were unnecessary in our fields, right? I was really focused in sales and trading, Kristen in investment banking. But can you talk a little bit about the role of those degrees and certifications in your role? And also, I want to know who your favorite philosopher is.
So you both know this, having worked in sales and trading and banking, there is a range of qualifications that people bring to those jobs. But I would say in sales and trading, the majority of people don't have degrees beyond a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. And there are people who have enormously senior positions all across finance, whether it's buy side, sell side, investment banking, sales trading, hedge fund, real money, whatever, who span a whole range of educational backgrounds. So it is simply not the case that one has to have a certain degree or any degree to do well and to go far in any place in finance. That said, I do think that having certain qualifications is an important signal in the hiring process, mm-hmm. especially if you want to go into something a little more technical in banking. And I do think that more and more education just gives you more and more optionality, whether you want to be in finance or something else. This is not always the case, but maybe because I'm risk averse, I like to build a lot of optionality into my life. And also because I was always quite paranoid that I just didn't know what everybody else in the room knew. Mm. I went for all these additional qualifications, and that's why I did the CFA, because I had gone to graduate school, but you know, I didn't do the degree that was really in vogue at the time. At the time, the late 1990s, when I was coming out of graduate school, the degree that was in vogue was a PhD in economics and then a stint at the IMF, because this is when EM was all the rage and fixed exchange rates were being overturned. And this is what was in hiring demand. And when I felt like I was lucky enough to get a job in a bank, I felt like I couldn't really follow the conversation. I suspected that if I did the CFA, I would lose every spring and summer of my life for 3 years getting that qualification, but I'd be able to keep up with the conversation. And, and I was right. You know, that CFA was never something that anyone asked me about when it was time to do the job or to be considered for a promotion or be considered for the next job. But it certainly gave me a lot of confidence that I knew what they were talking about and I could do some analysis, or I knew where to look up the framework in order to undertake the analysis myself. And that's why I continue to do all those CFA certificates, you know, whether it was something in data science, in climate investing, private markets. It's impossible that you can learn everything you need to learn before you get in a seat in a bank or at an investment manager. I can't see it costing you anything other than a bit of free time. So that's why I did it.
I mean, we get so many questions from our community asking, if I take the CFA, will that help me break into, and it's everything like investment banking, sales and trading, hedge funds, whatever it is. And our reply is always, look, it's probably not going to be the thing that gets you the job, but it is absolutely going to make you feel more confident. And to your point, understand just the world around you better. So if that's going to help you, whether it's in the interview or in your confidence, then I think it's so valuable. But
I've never thought it was a great idea to really advertise your credentials on Wall Street, mm-hmm. basically because there are many paths to proving yourself as a great salesperson, trader, investor, banker. And it's a bit conceited to sort of... assume that just because you went to a certain place or you studied a certain thing, that obviously you have this skill advantage over someone else, because there are so many people who have different skill sets or different backgrounds, and they still have the same equivalent amount of skill in the market. Mm-hmm. Wall Street is very humbling in that way, in that you realize that it is 100% performance based. And so that's one of the reasons why, even though I've been a CFA like my whole career, I've never put CFA in my footer. Like, it's just not.
And you had like a...
I'm very proud of that I did it, but...
Yeah. Jen, I think, had like looked up your bio and was like, he's a CFA level 4. We didn't even know that existed. And so...
it's like, what's beyond a black belt in karate?
It's not. It just means that they've offered some additional training outside of the core. Mm-hmm. It used to be a 3-year CFA curriculum. It's not the equivalent of a black belt that way. It's not, there's no kind of karate martial arts analog there.
But John, I also think that much of this is your personality. We've gotten to know you just briefly here. And when I first looked you up on LinkedIn, guys, to give you a sense of who John is, if you've never heard his name before, LinkedIn was like, people also search for Muhammad Alarian, like the former CEO of PIMCO, right? I mean, it is no joke how much you've accomplished in your career. Yet when we first emailed you, you were like, howdy. I was like, okay, I don't think... most approachable, nice, humble, down-to-earth dude we've ever met. So I think that that also speaks to your personality. So I'd love to switch gears a little bit and talk now about what the investment strategy is like that you're doing on the buy side, because we've talked to strategists on the sell side. But I'm curious, you said you wanted to be closer to the investing decisions. What does that actually look like? Are you recommending trade ideas? And I'd also love for you to define for our listeners what a super is, because that's not an American term.
Yeah,
it is not an American term. I work for a pension fund called Australian Super, and super is short for superannuation. And superannuation is the term used in Australia, as well as in the UK and a few other countries, for a pension fund. So think of it as Australian pension, mm-hmm. but it's called Australian Super, just given the vernacular in that market. So Australia is interesting in many ways, but from an investment standpoint, it's quite unique in that it's got a compulsory savings program. Every employer is required to pay 11% going up to 12% of every employee's wages into a pension program. And that starts from your first job and it goes until you retire. And that is quite unique, especially for anyone in the audience who's American and thinks about the likelihood that your employer, whether you're at McDonald's or JP Morgan, is putting 11% of your salary into the bank every day from 18 when you start the job to 65 when you retire.
Yeah, this doesn't happen in America.
No.
And might I just say that I actually got my Lehman Brothers pension 2 years ago. And it was not zero. I worked there for 24 months and that place was great. Barclays used to have a big pension program because they're British, but it's very, very rare in America in most corporate roles to have a pension like that versus like teachers, exactly. firefighters, et cetera, et cetera.
So the fact that it's universal is unique. The fact that the amount of the contribution is double digit is pretty unique too.
It's wild.
And because the size of that asset base in Australia is so large, it's about, I think, $3 trillion Australian dollars, which is about $2 trillion US. Ooh. Many of these pension funds, including the one I work for, have outgrown the local market. And this is why they have large offices in London, New York, to manage the non-Australian dollar assets. So I am heading up the investment strategy team. And that's a team that formulates the view on the public markets and the private markets, private equity, private credit, restructured real estate, plus equities and fixed income. And we make those recommendations to the heads of the different asset classes and the CIO and the investment committee. The idea is to help benchmark. So the way that this is close to investing, even though I don't make any final decision on which way we allocate, is that the group that I'm advising is my client base every day and will be my client base every day mm-hmm. as long as I'm here.
Yeah.
That's quite different from the sell side model. And on the sell side, you, as an analyst, are responsible for formulating the view on a particular market. You have clients that you're supposed to convey that information to. And they may or may not use your information. They may take your information and combine it with a lot of other people's information. And so you never really know what kind of impact you're having. You assume that because they invite you to come around every year that they like what you're saying, but it's a very indirect influence on someone's investment decision making. And for the most part, you know, if you feel like you are having an impact, you're only feeling it. You don't actually know it. When you work for an investment manager, whether it's real money, hedge fund, asset owner like us, you know you're having an impact because you're in that room with them every week when investment committee meets. You know exactly what positions they're putting on. And if those positions are the opposite of what you're saying, then clearly you're a contrarian indicator and maybe you don't have much longevity at that fund. But if there does seem to be some correspondence between the kind of work you do and the kind of risk that the fund is taking, pretty good indication that you're having some impact. So there's quite a big difference between buy side and sell side. The trade-off, though, is that if you're on the sell side, you're seeing such a variety of clients all the time, whether it's hedge funds, real money, asset manager, pension fund, that you are probably a little more in tune to a range of different market themes. You're probably refining your views in a way that gives you a higher quality view than you would have if you were only talking to one type of client every day. So I think when you're on the buy side, you have to find ways to make sure you're testing yourself and you're validating your views and being challenged on your views, given that you're only talking to one small set of people at a time.
Can I ask a really dumb question? Why is it called superannuation?
You know, for some reason, I'm having a flashback to Latin class, you know, when I was in Catholic school, and I'm thinking super means beyond and annuation means something related to growing or
there we go.
Yearly. And it's probably something
makes sense
related to that, like an annual contribution and it grows. But I have to check the issue.
Yeah, no, that makes complete sense. It's like an annuity that you're going to get into the future forever. Like, it actually makes complete sense. I like that word a lot better than a pension. So anyway, thank you.
John, I have a question for you. So from a fixed income investing standpoint, I'd love it if you could speak a little bit to the asset liability management aspect of what pension funds and supers are doing all day in the fixed income market. We've talked about this in the simplest terms in the past that, okay, well, if you are starting your job at whatever it may be today, and you intend to retire 30 years from now, your pension fund has a really long dated liability to pay you some money upon your retirement. We've talked about them needing to shore up that liability by investing in assets. But can you explain that a little bit more in depth for our listeners beyond my 101 level explanation of it that I typically give?
Sure. The idea is the following. We need income to live and to acquire the things that we want. And when we're able-bodied, we're able to generate that income through our labor and we can provide for ourselves. But obviously there's some point at which we don't work anymore. And the only way to provide ourselves is by having saved judiciously and prudently during our working years. So that's the logic behind saving. It shouldn't be that revelatory as a concept, but I think there's a big difference between the way people structure their savings. Some do it in a defined benefit type program where your employer guarantees you a certain income when you retire, which creates a huge sense of security to a saver because you know that regardless of what happens to the markets, you're going to be delivered a certain amount of income when you can't work anymore. But it, by contrast, creates a huge investment risk on the part of the company that manages that scheme. And surprise, surprise, defined benefits schemes are pretty much being either canceled or wound down because they just place too much risk on the pension fund. And those that are funded more through government payments, pay-as-you-go type systems, are finding that those governments are experiencing an ever greater fiscal liability, which is part of what's going on in the U.S. right now.
Yeah.
So
there'll be no Social Security left for us.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So something has to change on that system because it's a bit defined benefit in the face of very challenging demographics. So it's just kind of not viable. The alternative is defined contribution system, which is what Australian Super or the Australian system manages, where you put in a certain amount of money. It's always yours. The problem is you run sort of longevity risk, which is that you may live a lot longer than you think you will after you retire and you could run out of money.
High class problem to have, but
it's a very difficult one to model and to kind of plan for, because if you just really don't know how long you're going to live and you're a moderate income person, you run the risk of being impoverished later on in life. So there are other kind of hybrid systems that people have proposed where maybe there's a defined contribution system, but those of us who die earlier than we thought have whatever's in the pot transferred to everyone else. It's kind of a socialist mentality, but that's one way you could give people ownership of their money, but also give them some security. Those are kind of your two options. I'd say they both involve huge amounts of uncertainty. One is around investment risk. The other is around longevity risk. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of stuff that I'd say your average person and the vast majority of people don't think about because it just requires long-term planning and a lot of assumptions.
Right.
And unfortunately, it's a major public policy issue.
Yeah.
Not something that's talked about enough in finance. Probably not something that's talked about enough in a country like the U.S., which doesn't have a pension net for individuals. It kind of obscures the risk and lives with the consequences, which is a lot of older people who are poor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it is a more front and center public policy issue in some other countries that have a much more universal pension program.
Mm-hmm. No, it's definitely a problem. And, you know, I think it was interesting too. I saw an Instagram reel recently about younger millennials. Why do they have no loyalty to employers? Well, in the past, if you went to work at a company and you stayed there, you would get a pension and then you'd be set for life. And now you don't have that anymore. So it makes sense that people are off doing whatever's going to make sense for them.
Yes.
I actually have a quick question on just the day-to-day. Like, how much of the decisions that you're making and the strategy is about investing in different funds in the sense that the like David Swensen model of investing, where it's like you're going to allocate different amounts of money to some percent to equities, some percent to fixed income, some percent to the alternatives. For you, how much of it is saying, hey, I'm looking at these different hedge funds and these different private equity firms versus actually looking at the specific investment of, you know, I know you're focused on fixed income. So like, I want to buy X number of treasuries. And like, I don't even know, Jen's the fixed income expert. So wanted to understand how much is the managing of the actual funds versus the investment itself.
Sure. So it's going to vary by fund and it's going to vary over time. But essentially the two decisions that have to be made are how much of the assets are going to be managed internally within the, the fund versus externally with another manager and how much of that should be in liquid markets like fixed income and equities versus illiquid markets such as private equity, private credit, infrastructure, and real estate. The external versus internal question is a function of the trade-off between fees and expertise. If you think you can find the expertise, then it's almost always more cost efficient to in-house the management of it and use all those fees that you used to pay in order to build intellectual capital within the organization. And as long as you can do no worse than the managers that you used to pay, then you're going to pocket a lot in terms of the savings. And that's been the model, the fund I work for. And that's increasingly the model with a lot of the other Australian pension funds is they're taking more from external managers, bringing it more internal, using the fee savings to build up the in-house expertise. And there's still enough cost savings to pass that to the members in terms of lower fees to them. So there's a logic to it. And it's around cost savings and building up intellectual capital internally. The liquid versus illiquid decision, I think, is guided a lot by the different demographics of various countries' pension systems. Meaning if you're a country like Australia, which has a relatively young population, meaning the majority of the members who are in the scheme are in this accumulation of the phase where they're paying into the fund and they're not in the decumulation phase where they're withdrawing from the fund, you can afford to have things tied up in that Yale model of illiquid assets, whether that's private assets, things like infrastructure, real estate, kind of long-lived assets. Whereas if the demographic is tilted the other way, if an increasing share of the membership base is in that retirement phase and drawing from the plan, then you can't really be as much in liquid markets because you can't sell these and turn them into cash. So this is why you see a lot of variation in how funds are structured. A lot of it has to do with whether or not they think they can hire the right people based on where they're located and how they want to manage things. And a lot of this liquid versus illiquid split depends on what's the nature of the liabilities and how soon they're due. But this is also why, you know, a lot of universities gravitate towards the illiquid model as they figure once the endowment is of a certain size, they don't need to contribute as much to the operating budget of the school and they can afford to have more tied up in those assets. It's a high class problem. You know, most universities outside of five or six that we can all name can't really afford to be in that Yale model.
Yeah.
They have to contribute too much to the operating budget.
Got it. So thank you. That was super helpful.
Okay. So question for you, Australian super specific. I know very little about the Australian rates market. I have no idea if the curve is inverted like it is in the US. I know nothing about that, but I assume that your investments fall outside of just Australian dollar denominated investments. So you're running rate risk, currency risk, credit risk, most likely if you're a yield-based buyer out the curve and things like that. I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about your expertise across the range of fixed income products and what risks you're thinking about specifically along those fixed income product verticals?
Sure. So because the fund is invested in every asset class, public and private, and because I work on asset allocation now, whereas before some of my roles were narrower and asset class specific, I'm working on just a range of issues that I never had a chance to explore on the sell side. when I was on the sell side, I never looked at private markets. So it's quite different because the organization is different, its exposures are different. To the extent that I get involved in the much more liquid asset classes, such as rates, for example, I would say the framework is unchanged. You know, one always has a view on whether or not growth is going to be accelerating or decelerating, whether or not inflation is picking up or slowing down, how a central bank is going to respond to that macro backdrop that it sees now and that it thinks is going to prevail over the next few months, and thinking about or modeling what that macro environment should be priced at in the fixed income markets. Then you look at where the fixed income market is priced and make a judgment as to whether it's rich or cheap versus that view. So that's kind of the standard approach. Start with a macro view on what the world's going to look like, quantitatively model what that view should be priced at in terms of rate levels or currency levels, look at then where the forward rates are, and then decide whether this is a buy or sell type trade.
I'm curious, are you willing to share your macro view with us? I know it's a Fed day today, and this will likely air significantly in the future. So we will not hold you to anything you say today, as by the time this episode airs, we could have gone from pricing in whatever, like a 75% chance of one cut this year to now all of a sudden 10 hikes or 10 cuts. But
sure.
I'm curious if you're willing to share your current view.
No, I'll share it and I'll make it more medium term. I'm kind of used to doing that given where I work right now. So I think 2024 in terms of growth is good, not great. I think inflation is stuck, but not stuck forever. And I think policy is going to be easing, but very slowly. And I'll talk about what that means for markets. So in terms of why growth is good, but not great, it's good because it's picking up in those countries that had very weak growth, and that includes Europe and China. It's slowing down in the economy that was overheating, which is the US. And I think of that as an important and a helpful result. I think of inflation as gradually moving lower because there's some supply side improvement and there's some demand moderation in a place that used to generate a lot of inflation, like the US. And I think of policy as responding to that change in backdrop very slowly because central banks haven't hit inflation targets and they're mindful of a reacceleration in growth that's going to compromise those targets even more. Now, what that means in terms of asset class performance is I feel very strongly that if growth is just trend, you're going to get equities beating fixed income. And generally, it's just trend growth is good enough for getting private markets to be public markets. These are kind of simple empirical consistencies that you see in the data. And I don't see a big reason to really question whether that's still the right path. Where I do have more questions is around what things look like after 2024. I think if AI delivers on its promise, then you can have an economy that runs reasonably strong for quite a while. And maybe this ends up being a business cycle that rivals some of those business cycles that we saw in other periods of high productivity, like the late 90s. And that means the expansion could go on for another 5 years or so, rather than getting snuffed out in the next couple of years. So there's a lot going on thematically and structurally around the global economy. It has a lot of important echoes to what happened in the late 1990s. I think that's going to have a big influence on the degree to which people believe the cycle goes on for many years rather than just another two or three. It has a lot of implications for how much visibility there is on earnings and equity outperformance over the next few years. It has huge implications for whether U.S. assets outperform non-U.S. assets over the next few years, because U.S. has been since the Industrial Revolution a place that really germinates all of these innovations. So I find the next year to be kind of vanilla cyclical stories that are still good enough to get equities to outperform. I think the much more interesting questions are kind of the structural ones that take us past 24 into 25 and 26.
Yeah. I mean, this is totally off topic, but as you were talking about AI, I'm curious just what your view is on how you think that that's going to change roles for younger people who are starting in their careers and looking to potentially go into finance.
I like to think that AI is a great enabler rather than replacement. Meaning, in the most simple terms, AI is just a non-human agent that's solving problems at a much greater speed and at a much greater scope that humans can solve. Kind of like industrialization that mechanized a lot of production, except that what it facilitates is knowledge creation itself. So not only helps you work faster, but potentially helps you create the next thing that could help you work faster. So it's extremely promising in that regard. I guess my fear is that because AI is something really relevant to the knowledge industry, that people who are not in knowledge-based jobs are not really going to be beneficiaries. So it's kind of the same divide that's been opening up for the past 20 years anyway, that skilled labor gets much more highly compensated than unskilled labor.
Interesting.
Skilled labor can work even more efficiently and be compensated better if they're doing it with this non-human agent that allows them to be more productive. And yet there's nothing to help those who are generally unskilled. Because if you do manual work, the scope for AI to really make you more efficient, and that is limited. So I look at it as hugely important for lifting the average boat, but also increasing the divergence between like the fastest boats.
But if you need to pick up a boat with a machine, this does not help you.
This is fascinating because I feel like it's almost the opposite of what I have been hearing, which is that if you are in a knowledge-based role, that essentially you're going to ultimately get replaced. Meanwhile, if you're going into some of these roles, like if you're a plumber, AI can't do that. So now you're safe.
There will always be some knowledge-based roles that are completely eliminated because the knowledge-based role can be completely mechanized. But there are a lot of knowledge-based roles that can't really be mechanized, and there's always a need for discretion or judgment or some value-added dimension to it. So take a simple example. If your job is working at a call center and the call center's responsibility is just to convey the absolute most basic risk-free information, I don't think there's a future for that job. If, by contrast, you're an attorney and one requirement of your discovery process is to review hundreds, thousands of pages of documentation for every case, but you've also got to exercise a judgment as to what particular point of law should you argue this case on. You're going to be a lot more efficient because the 1,000 pages has been summarized by ChatGPT, but you still need to be able to make that judgment call as to how are you going to argue this in front of the judge. So this is why I think most of these knowledge-based jobs will become more productive. It's just more output per hour worked.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a small minority of these that are gone, but you know, that's the case with any kind of technological process.
Yeah. I will say I had this conversation with someone the other day and I wanted help and they just kept sending me links of what it said on the website. And I'm like, this is not what I'm trying to talk to you for. I could look that up, or a ChatGPT could look that up for me. I actually want help. Can you find me a human to help me fix my problem?
Well, look, that's a legitimate argument that that's a legitimate argument that part of what people want in a service industry is empathy. And so unless the non-human agent can somehow be programmed with or can learn those empathic qualities, it's always going to be considered substandard. But, but who knows? Maybe empathy is something that an algorithm can develop. It's a bit creepy, but
It's like the
maybe the future.
I know.
Unsubscribe. I don't want any of it. John, totally separate question. Something that's happening in the news right now, dollar yen. You've had a 30-year career in the industry, and I think this is probably the first time where we've had non-zero negative Japanese interest rates, and now we've got intervention from the Bank of Japan. I'm curious if you can put on your FX strategy hat for a second. What do you think's going on there?
I think what's going on is a currency that's simply tracking the most extreme rate divergence in the world right now, which is US rates being high-ish in nominal terms, high in real terms, Japanese rates being extremely low in nominal terms, negative in real terms.
And sorry to interrupt you, but for our non-inflation oriented listeners, can you please explain the difference between nominal and real rates? I think we talked about this briefly with Brian Weinstein, but I'd love to touch on it again if people aren't like, I remember episode 12.
A nominal interest rate is just what you observe. It's what you're paid in your bank account. It's what that treasury bond that you own is paying you. And the real return is that nominal rate minus inflation. And that's a measure of your purchasing power. So if interest rates are going up more quickly than the rate of inflation, then you actually have something substantive to buy things with. And if the opposite is true, where inflation is running higher than the rate of interest in your earning, then prices are going up faster than your bank account is benefiting from the interest rates, and you're actually losing your ability to buy things. So Japan has negative real rates. US has positive real rates. The difference between those real rates and nominal rates is very large in the historical context. I'd say it's pretty close to a 30-year wide. And that's also, surprise, surprise, one of the reasons the exchange rate is at a 30-year high for the US dollar versus the Japanese yen. The logic here is that an exchange rate can be thought of as simply the price of money between two countries, where one money pays X interest rate, another one plays Y interest rate. So that's not the only reason currencies move. It's not the only influence in the market, but it's a big, a lot of investors are simply moving cash from low yield to high yield. And that explains a lot of it. I think this process is going to start to move in reverse, but probably not for another 6 months, and probably not to a significant degree. Meaning, I do think in 6 months, the Fed will cut, but if it cuts only 75 basis points over the cycle, the rate differential with Japan doesn't narrow that much. There'll be some help from the Bank of Japan, which is going to be hiking rates this year. But if they're only moving once a quarter and maybe they only move 100 basis points over the cycle, then you have a narrower rate differential between US and Japan, but it'll still favor US. And that's why to think about whether the yen is suddenly going to start appreciating because the Fed cuts rates, or the yen is going to appreciate significantly because the Bank of Japan hikes rates, I don't think so. I think the scope for the yen to appreciate is 5, maybe 10% max. That only takes the yen back to where it started the year.
This cycle,
yeah. Still a rate differential that's going to persist for a while. And there's still going to be, I think, a global bid for U.S. equity assets if you believe that tech stocks and AI kind of early innings around this kind of innovation boom.
Right.
There's still only one place to buy those kind of equities in size. And this is something that keeps the dollar a lot stronger for a lot longer, even as the Fed cuts.
John, to what you're talking about, for any student of macroeconomic theory and of trading history, this is what we've always called the carry trade.
Yes.
And John, it's funny because when Kristen and I first started this project, everyone kept talking about carry in the private equity context of referring to carried interest.
Yes.
And I was like, that's not what carry is. I know what carry is. It's the differential between where you invest and you fund yourself.
Correct.
You just did a phenomenal job explaining the fundamentals of a carry trade for our listeners. And I'd love if you could just talk a little bit about the history of the yen carry trade for those who are not students of macroeconomic history.
Sure. So I guess the short history of the yen carry trade is that when FX investors look to earn carry, they've traditionally wanted to earn it by shorting the yen against something. It's not always been the US dollar. It's at times been the Australian dollar. It's at times been emerging market currencies. But they've wanted to sell yen and buy some other currency because the yen has been a zero or near zero yield currency since the Nikkei equity bubble burst in late 1989, early 1990. So the aftermath of that financial crisis and that asset market implosion was deflation, which the central bank tried to combat by taking rates down to those levels. So because the rate structure in Japan has been compressed for so long, Japan was always seen as the extremely safe funding currency. The problem is that on a recurring basis, the other side of that carry trade, which is the high yield currency, sometimes experiences some macroeconomic shock. So there have been shocks like the global financial crisis where commodity prices collapsed by 50%. And surprise, surprise, no one wants to own a high yield commodity currency, Brazilian real, Mexican peso, Australian dollar, or New Zealand dollar. And so the history of the carry trade is basically up by the steps, down by the elevator shaft, I guess is the term that used to be used. It has this very long extended period of low vol appreciation in the high yield currency. And then this very sudden collapse in the value of the high yield currency, which occurs over a month, over a quarter, over 6 months, extremely quickly in a way that almost wipes out all prior gains. So the trick is really to time it with a mind towards when the macro shock could occur in that high yield economy. And some people have managed to do that pretty well, and many people haven't. So that's kind of the sad, messy history of the carry trade.
No, I love it. And I appreciate that. I don't know if they teach those things in school anymore to the youngins, but hopefully we can do that here. So I really appreciate that.
I can't remember if I actually learned that in school. I took like 3 economics classes.
I'm joking about in school. They don't teach that
I mean,
School of the Hard Knocks, AKA your analyst year on an interest rate derivative desk.
There are lots of reasons to care about this. If you're just a pure currency investor, this is kind of bread and butter of how people try to generate alpha. But even if you're just an equity investor who wonders what's all this noise going on in the currency, you should be mindful of the fact that the currency could move 20% in a quarter because of a macro shock. And so what you thought of as a fantastic equity trade ends up being a really lousy one, not because something happened to the equity, but because something happened to the currency. So even if you
think the FX component,
FX is just a random market, as many people think it is, it's still an exposure and it still has this tendency to gap in a way which can impose a material loss on investors.
Well, I love the crash course. Thank you for doing some fixed income educating here. I have a bold question to ask. How does a pension fund make money?
Well, there are two ways. One is the benchmark way, and the other is the active way. So the benchmark way is to say, even if we as a pension fund have no view on whether a particular market is going to go up or down more than another one, we've chosen a benchmark, which requires us to allocate a portion of the assets in certain asset classes, which we believe over time will be going up. Mm-hmm. And because we know empirically that equities go up 8 out of 10 years, that also over time, unlisted markets like private markets, real estate, infrastructure, also have these fairly extended periods of outperformance versus public markets, that we want those in the benchmark in certain fixed proportions, because if we're willing to hold those for a minimum of 5, 10, 20 years, they're more than likely going to go up. Mm-hmm. You know, the only environment or state of the world in which they're not going to go up is if all those countries that we're invested in are in deflation. Because if you're in deflation, there's no profits growth. And if there's no profits growth, there's no outperformance of equities versus fixed income or private equity versus anything else. And that's kind of the lesson of Japan. It was the experience of continental Europe for a long time. But that's the only reason you should not be in risky markets, is you fear deflation and no nominal GDP growth and no profits growth. So I guess the easy way to make money, if you're a pension fund or anyone else, is just always be long or always own more risky markets than safe markets. Mm-hmm. Now, if you do that, you're probably going to make 7 to 8% a year on average, which is good. But the idea is that we want to try to maximize the return for our members. So we want to do more than the benchmark. And the way we do that is by making relative value decisions about which market's going to do better or worse over that long-term horizon. So the idea is that over 10 years, all these markets are going to outperform fixed income and cash. But we think that for whatever reason, private equity might do a little better than public equity, or we think infrastructure might do a little better than real estate. And so we buy a bit more of those things we like. We fund it by underweighting those things we don't do as well. And the difference in performance is alpha and is additive to whatever you're going to earn on the benchmark. So it's reasonably simple to kind of structure conceptually. Mm-hmm. It's harder to get the calls right.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because you know, you got to get the business cycle right, and you have to get the structural ideas right. You know, real estate sounded like an amazing asset class to own pre-COVID because interest rates were so low and real estate is a leveraged asset. But of course, COVID came and not as many people want to go to the office. And so commercial real estate is terrible. Mm-hmm. And you know, you really couldn't have seen that coming unless you saw COVID coming.
Right.
So there are a number of wild cards that can upset, you know, even a very sound, rational investment process for choosing winners and losers over time.
Right.
Stupid question. Do you get paid a fee structure based on assets under management? Do you get paid some portion of the alpha on top? Like, how does that work relative to other fund managers?
So there are fees charged to the members for the management of the assets. The idea is to minimize those fees as much as possible because that can be given back to the members in terms of returns. And, mm-hmm. and one of the ways that fees are reduced as much as possible is by managing the assets in-house. So mm-hmm. unless the external managers could deliver a higher return net of fees, it makes sense to bring those funds in-house and take the difference in fees and pass that on to the mm-hmm. members. But it's not a structure which is in any way comparable fee-wise to what goes on in, let's say, well, certainly not the hedge funds.
Hedge funds, yeah.
And probably not the real money asset manager world. And it has to do with the governance structure of the pension fund, that the pension fund is mm-hmm. more or less owned by the members. And so the incentive is to reduce the fees as much as possible so that the members benefit. We don't have shareholders in the way that an asset manager who's listed on an exchange has shareholders. And therefore, the incentive is to not only grow the assets under management, but to create more high fee products mm-hmm. in order to boost the profits and the margins of the asset manager, return that extra to the shareholder. The shareholder is the member mm-hmm. here. And so the incentives are quite different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And sometimes I think there's a willingness to pay fees because some people think of certain investment vehicles as lottery tickets. And so mm-hmm. they feel like they're happy to pay that 2 and 20 or whatever it is, because they really think they've done the right manager selection work and they're going to end up at that one fund or handful of funds that delivers outstanding returns consistently. Yeah. It's just that the lottery ticket model works the same way, I think, everywhere. Meaning very few people win.
Yeah. Unless you're Rentec.
Yeah.
But yes. Yeah. Yeah.
John, question for you. Now that you have the perspective of being at a super during the GFC, you were at JP Morgan, right?
Yes. Yes.
So we get all the time on social media, people being like, you ruined the pension funds of firefighters and teachers in 2008. Investment bankers are the scum of the earth. What's your take on how history views that and what is signal and what is noise? And now that the dust has somewhat settled 17 years later.
I think history is pretty uncharitable towards the financial industry with respect to its role in the financial crisis. And it's uncharitable in the sense that the view is usually pretty incomplete. Mm. So it's not that finance played mm-hmm. no role in it. It's just that many other people played accomplice roles as well. Mm-hmm. So it's just not possible for banks to overextend credit unless you have borrowers who want to take on excess credit.
And unless you have government policies in place that encourage lending to people who are not qualified to take up those loans.
All of that. So there is, it is one of those crises, maybe it's the crisis, where there was a lot of blame that deservedly needed to be dished out to a lot of different parts of the financial system. And it always bothered me that, you know, the view on this was very myopic. It didn't surprise me that it was myopic.
Mm.
Many public policy issues which are presented in very skewed ways. But but that was one that I think always stood out to me, is just how kind of narrow and self-serving these accounts of what happened in the crisis were.
Right. Well, it's one of these things where anytime something gets complicated, people don't like complicated stories. They just like black and white. This is the bad guy, the end. And it's very easy to say, oh, like this bad thing happened. It was the investment bankers. Look at them making all their money, you know? And it's like, well, let's talk about, again, to Jen's point, this whole lending environment and the fact that, you know, there was a policy, people should own homes. We want people to be able to buy homes, da 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 da. Now, all of a sudden, you have banks, they need to be able to lend more money, they need to get stuff off their balance sheet. Like, it's like, there's a reason that it happened, but that part's not really kind of the fun, sexy story. It's a lot easier to tell a story about a banker being a bad guy. So,
yeah, like as strange as it sounds, I think I became more charitable towards the finance industry after leaving it, going back to school and studying philosophy.
Oh,
the reason a philosophy degree made me more charitable towards finance is because we spent some time studying and writing about this concept of role ethics, which is that there are many ways to define ethics. You know, some people think of ethics as kind of these absolute principles that apply to everyone at all times in every domain. An alternative account is that people have certain roles in society, and there's a different ethical code for people depending on what their role is. So the role of finance is to allocate capital in order to maximize economic efficiency. And in the pursuit of that economic efficiency, people in finance are allowed to do many things that you would normally not really condone.
Mm-hmm.
They're allowed to pursue their own personal financial self-interest. And everyone's doing this all the time. I mean, you as an individual investor are making a decision to buy something purely based on what it does for you. And you're not thinking of that in charitable terms about what it does for the rest of society. But the reason you're allowed to do that is because the price mechanism has to work in order to allocate capital. And that's why you're excused from having to think about everyone else in the world when you make your own personal portfolio decisions. And that's why banks are excused from thinking about all these societal needs when they're making their financing decision. It's not to say we don't then have other responsibilities in society. You know, I've got a responsibility as a taxpayer, as a dad, as a friend, as a neighbor, whatever. But it's just to say that around certain particular decisions, it's about what are the responsibilities of that role. And, you know, the finance role is to allocate capital, and it's not to solve every other problem on the planet.
Yeah. And I think that there is also, like, in societies that obviously tend to do very well, I also think tend to leverage human nature. And so I've been listening to some podcast episodes, because again, I'm like a podcast junkie, on the what's happening with the environment and like, how do we fix it? And the answer is not shame people into not eating beef and doing all these things. It's like finding the better technology that can help the world cool and not get to these like crazy, terrifying tipping points. Like, shaming people, like, that just doesn't work.
Well, I think it's about finding principles that are defensible. Mm. We may all agree on what this goal is.
That's true.
Whether it's environmental, social, whatever. But there are certain principles to guide those actions that if you use that same principle in so many other domains, you'd realize why that's not the right principle that's supposed to, to ground this. It's supposed to be something else.
Yeah.
And so what I find missing often in these public policy debates is people aren't getting the principle right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're choosing a very handy principle, which if you really thought about, you know, what would be the consequences of applying that quite broadly, you'd realize that's not the best reason to do it. There's some other better reason to do it. And the debate needs to be more about the reason, because that's a little more portable across different issues.
I love the philosopher's framework for the financier. I think that's fantastic. And that brings me back to one of my first questions that I never got answered. Who was your favorite philosopher?
Peter Singer. Peter Singer is a...
Really?
Wait, is he the effect of altruism?
Oh, you're a Princeton man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So Peter Singer just retired from Princeton as a philosopher. And so I don't know if either of you ran across him when you were there, but I had never heard of him until I started my program at LSE. And I picked up a book that he wrote about 25 years ago called Practical Ethics. And the point of that book, which is really Peter Singer's gift, is that he can take enormously complex and controversial and emotive issues and isolate that one point on which the argument turns. And he can convince you that the point that's been used to justify something is actually the wrong way to think about it. And so once you accept his preferred way to think about what motivates that action, you start to see how so many other things you believe about so many other policies are not really consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So he really goes for identifying the core premise of the argument, shows you why that premise is just not valid.
Yeah.
And once you abandon that, you realize you've got to rethink 10 other things, that it just doesn't hang together. And to think like someone who just had that capacity of insight to enormously complicated issues is someone who's made enormous like intellectual contributions to so many fields.
And who's like alive and well and walking amongst us as a mere mortal, you know?
Exactly. Now he's on his kind of world tour to convince everyone that some of these ideas are the most reasonable ideas. And I just admire that, A, he had the capacity to frame issues in that very simplified, accessible way. And I admire that, you know, he's in his 70s or 80s and still going.
Wow.
Like he's not giving up, that he really...
Hope he has a good pension plan.
Thinks he has some ideas. Well, so he's my favorite.
It's so interesting because there is the whole philosophy behind effective altruism. It actually, I guess to me, like it does make a lot of sense. And I do think it's a little bit sad kind of what happened with Sam Bankman-Fried, because at one point he was obviously like a champion of it and I think helped elevate the idea. And then when Sam Bankman-Fried obviously got arrested and then sentenced, and it's like, oh, see, it's all a scam, all these people. But I think it's actually really unfortunate, because I think like if you are someone who is very successful and you did say, hey, I'm going to make a commitment to give away most of what I'm earning, that is good. And I almost think that what happened with SBF, it then becomes an excuse like, oh, see, nobody actually really believed in it anyway. So it's like an excuse to then not give back is very damaging.
It is. I agree 100%. It's unfortunate that he became kind of the poster child for that movement, because there's so much sensibility behind the idea.
Yeah.
The idea is that, A, you know, those of us who have means should give to others, because we just don't derive any utility from our income and our savings after a certain point. And so many other people would, with small reallocations. It's kind of the basic logic behind any kind of redistributive policy, whether it's implemented by a government or implemented by an individual.
Yeah.
There are huge welfare gains from giving a little bit from people who are well-resourced to people who are not resourced. But the idea was that if you're going to give to people, you should at least do a bit of homework and make sure that it is doing the greatest good possible. So there's not much benefit, and I hate to say this knowing where both of you went to school, in building another fancy dorm at an elite university. But there's a lot of benefit in giving scholarships to first generation undergrads whose parents did not go to college. And so just bringing that, you know, slightly more empirical lens to altruism and philanthropy, I think was a huge insight and pretty easy concept to buy into. What Bankman-Fried did was just defraud people in order to fund that altruism, which there's absolutely no grounding for that, you know, in religion and in philosophy and common sense.
Yeah.
So I guess that movement will kind of have a revival as he's sort of forgotten. But I think the logic of it was really compelling. And it's a way for, I think, finance people, especially the more socially minded finance people, to understand why it's okay to work in finance and still be socially committed. If you are self-aware enough to realize that you're incredibly privileged to work in an organization that gives you or provides you an above average income, you should at least have the good grace to help other people either along the way or once you feel like you've made it to the right place. And that's the way you can kind of marry this commitment to yourself to do the things that you think are really interesting, like work in finance, and these commitments to other people, because you're fundamentally a generous person and you care about other people.
Yeah, love that.
When is your book coming out? That was absolutely fantastic. That's like one giant soundbite. I love it. Well, John, listen, this was absolutely phenomenal. You are so incredibly knowledgeable and thoughtful, and we are so grateful for your contribution. Any parting words of wisdom for our young listeners as they think about approaching their careers, or for our seasoned practitioners who are either interested in strategy, interested in knowing more about supers, philosophy? I don't know. What you got?
So I think whether you're new in this industry or old in this industry, I think it always pays to get current and keep current. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've had to retool every 5 to 7 years in the industry because, you know, fundamentally got to formulate views on an economy that's dynamic and unstable and innovative. And it would be just sort of naive to think that the stuff I learned 30 years ago was always going to be as relevant as it was back then. So I don't think you can kind of underestimate the benefits of learning, continuing to learn as you go through this process. And, you know, my guess is most people in finance are really, really curious. That's probably a defining characteristic of people in finance. They really want challenges and they like to be tested and they like the dynamism that finance brings. But this ability to engage with the dynamism is also a requirement to kind of keep the skills up.
Well, thank you so much. Hopefully this is the first conversation of many. We'd love to have you back. And we are so grateful for you. Congrats on all your success.
Thank you.
We wish you the best of luck in your relatively new role.
Thank you for the invitation and good luck on your new business venture, which I know you're going to be providing more info on pretty soon.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, John.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to The Wall Street Skinny. We are more than just a podcast, so follow us on TikTok and Instagram at The Wall Street Skinny. If you're a visual learner, we have content that will help get you up the curve from valuation to Excel to Bond Fundamentals 101. And if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to our YouTube channel where we will be publishing in-depth tutorials on all this and more.